Welcome to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. My name is Michael Welch. August 6th is Hiroshima Day. It marks the 70th anniversary of the first detonation of an atomic bomb over a civilian population. This week's Global Research News Hour commemorates the anniversary of the dawn of the nuclear age by presenting three past interviews relating to the new nuclear threat. We'll hear a December 6, 2013 interview with a lay researcher named Patrick Penry, who has uncovered through Freedom of Information requests the hidden facts surrounding the extent of the damage caused by the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility 4 years ago. This interview is followed by a January 16, 2015 interview with Mimi Gurman, an Earth activist monitoring radiation from Fukushima and other sources. And we'll finish the show with a June 20th, 2013 interview with Global Research founder and director Michelle Chalcedovsky about threats posed by the use of tactical nuclear weapons in the theater of conventional warfare. The Global Research News Hour will resume normal regular broadcasts in September. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission was subjected to a string of Freedom of Information requests in the days following the crippling of the nuclear facility in Fukushima, Japan. The documents released through these requests reveal that we've been deceived about the true nature of what happened at the complex and how dire the situation is there. Moreover, these official documents, which encompass email trails and transcripts of phone conversations among head officials, directly contradict the official story, including what we were told about current goings-on at the plant. Musician and citizen journalist Tony Muga, who goes by the pseudonym Patrick Penry, is largely responsible for bringing this documentation to the attention of the wider public. He has a complete archive on his site, patrickpenry.wordpress.com, and he joins us now from Gainesville, Florida. Thank you for joining us, Tony.
Thanks, Michael, and I appreciate the introduction there. You did a great job, and it's a pleasure and honor to be on your broadcast, because as I talked to you before, I mentioned I've referred to Global Research numerous times in my investigations, and a number of articles there have really been pieces of the puzzle for me to help me to put together a better picture. So I can thank you guys for that, if nothing else right now.
Well, appreciate it very much, Tony, because it's certainly this does seem to be a what you've exposed seems to be quite a shocker. So it starts with these Freedom of Information requests. Could you who exactly filed these Freedom of Information requests in the first place?
Well, initially there were a couple of groups that I'm aware of that filed for the documents, and Friends of the Earth was one group. The other group was the Associated Press. Now, there may have been other people in between, but I'm not aware of any other specifics. But between those two, and especially the Associated Press, I'm told, is sent off for about 90% of the requests. So if you go to the NRC website and you log in and you look, the vast majority of those, according to what my research indicates, are being filed by someone at the Associated Press. I'm not familiar with who, but that would be kind of who some of these environmental groups initiated and filed initially right after the event happened. By late June, early July, documents were beginning to collect into that online pool on the NRC database.
Mm. Okay, so you can connect, is there a pattern to, like you mentioned, both the Associated Press and environmental groups? Is there any kind of a pattern in terms of who's requesting what, or is it all pretty much the same territory?
It just seems to me, Michael, that at least with the Associated Press, because I think Friends of Earth just initially filed for a few documents here and there. AP has been consistently filing for them, and it just seems, if I were to make a guess, I think they're just making a wide sweeping grab and trying to acquire as much of a range of information as possible. I can't specifically look and say, oh, they're trying to get this kind of telephone transcript or this specific date or so on and so forth. So I think it's just a wide-range grab to get all the transcripts and telephone conversations, emails, all that kind of information, and get it into a body on the NRC website where you or I or anyone can go in there and research and get into it.
Now, how did you come to discover this information?
Okay, initially there was a website online. I've been critical of some of these websites because they didn't give that much information. They could have done so much more. But to their credit, E-Informable is a Lucas Hickson site, and Joy Thompson was, I don't know if she still writes with Informable or not, but she had a really great article early on that called it a can of worms. It opened up a, quote, can of worms, and I thought to myself, yeah, this is worms, all right. So, but I will say this, Michael, on the whole, it's been very suppressed. I've been studying controlled opposition since February of 2012 when I would send this information out, myself and other researchers, and it was largely ignored. And we didn't cover everybody. Like, I never contacted Michael Rupert. I don't know why I never did. I never thought of it. But I sent to other websites and alternative media outlets, and they basically ignored it. So I liken it to a fumble on the football field. And I'm looking around at all these better runners and better players, and they don't pick up the ball. And so I just grab it and run a few feet and set it down.
Well, yeah, how do you interpret that? I mean, you mentioned the term controlled demolition. Is there possibly a simpler explanation? Maybe just, what was that? I guess there's that saying, the bigger the lie, the harder it is to believe
well,
that.
That's true, and they have a very well put together false scenario and a false accountability of what the damage, what happened there. In this book I'm writing now, I'm going to explain and go into greater detail. Yes, there's a cover-up to protect our nuclear industry. But if you want to look at that tsunami drill and go into the conspiracy theory area, I believe there's other reasons as well. I'm going to flesh that out in this book I'm working on now. So I'm tend to write now just, you know, until I've done more research and done some more. So far, my hypothesis has held watertight, but until I'm really confident with it and I finish this thing I'm writing right now, I just kind of want to hold off on that. So what we, like I say, with Rupert, I told him we can all agree that there was some damage there. We know it was pretty catastrophic. And just judging from the amount of damage and the effects of what that are going to be, I think in an open forum and discussion, most informed Americans would agree with us that as soon as we can, we need to start looking into some means of decommissioning plants and providing some alternative means of power. Maybe even Americans saying to themselves, we might need to adjust our lifestyles a little bit and maybe not use so much power.
Yeah. Now, the documentation was disclosed, it includes email trails, but also includes transcripts of phone conversations. Is this like among head officials? These sorts of conversations, is that essentially a requirement that in all of these discussions that they're all recorded?
That is my understanding, Michael, that there's an emergency like this. In fact, they actually do transcriptions from all their meetings around the country, public meetings. The NRC documents pretty much everything they do. And there's an emergency or some kind of event, the recorders are on, they're keeping everything, but the thing is, my understanding is, you won't ever even hear that unless someone files for the transcripts and the phone conversations. Yes, they record it, but unless somebody out here on the outside world requests it, you know, they just hold on to it and, you know, might not get to see anything at all if we're not requesting it. So Freedom of Information Act, I tell you, it's one of the most beautiful things this country has going for it.
Yeah, it's like certainly, I mean, even in dealing with, police officers, I mean, they'll basically be able to get away with things by not, as long as you don't know your rights, they're not sort of obliged to tell you, and they can capitalize on that. So it sounds like the same kind of principle.
Very similar, exactly. Good example.
Okay. Now, let's talk about some of these main disclosures. I know one of them has to do with the spent fuel pool number 4. Now, just to define our terms, I mean, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about a spent fuel pool?
Okay, that's where the fuel that has been in the reactor and been used to its full potential, at least according to our current technology, once they're done with that fuel, and it's in a very excited, heated state. It's very hot. You have to put it into a temporary holding pool with a special coolant water that's circulating to keep a number of years until the temperature comes down enough where they can offload it into what's called a dry cask and then store it, you know, for long-term storage somewhere else. So that spent fuel pool is it's many meters deep. I'm not exactly certain how many meters, but these control rods are many meters long. A person can't just lift one up yourself. They have that big machine, take them in and out, as many have seen in the TEPCO videos alleging to be Unit 4. So it's simply just a temporarily great place to hold these heated fuel rods until they cool enough to dry cast them for permanent storage.
Okay. Now, what we've been told in recent weeks, starting on the 18th, that there is a major operation to remove fuel rods from the assemblies in these spent fuel pools to do it safely. And there's been a lot of controversy of whether or not TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Corporation, is competent enough to do all that. And, you know, a lot of associated commentary coming from experts like Arne Gunderson. But what have you revealed about spent fuel pool number four that would seem to, I don't know, contradict a lot of the current news we're hearing?
Okay, first, I quickly want to say that I'm not an absolute expert on nuclear power, but there are other people who are, but they don't want to speak out about these documents. So to be clear, I'm kind of learning as I go along, and if I make a mistake, I'll go back. And like today on your show, I kind of made a correction from FOIA stuff on Rupert's show. I misspoke about these documents are ongoing and so on and so forth. So I just want to be clear, I'm not an expert. The ones who are, I would say, are kind of remaining quiet on these documents. Now, that being said, with spent fuel pool number four, in these documents, there on number four, there's a mountain of evidence. I mean, it's huge. I could write another giant article again with all new stuff because it's consistent that four had some kind of a leak and loss of inventory, and when that happened, there's what they call a zirconium fire. The cladding on the spent fuel, it reaches a temperature where it bursts into flames. It's very difficult to extinguish. It's called a pyrophoric fire. You can't just spray water on it necessarily. It's like magnesium burning. So in these documents, there's just so much evidence that there's a melt on the floor, rubble on the floor, walls blown out. I mean, I kind of beat a dead horse when I start reading from this one document because it's so obvious to me, you know. And then when Rupert looked into this stuff and felt so strong about it, that made me feel even better because always in my mind, I always double check and rethink, and I try and, you know, hammer, get into my, debunk my own stuff if I can. And so far this is pretty watertight. If you look at the TEPCO footage, there's nothing conclusive that doesn't say it's not stock footage or they're shooting it down at Diani. And TEPCO's notoriously, inaccurate with their information. I'll put it that way. So. Just a wealth of information in there, that walls blown out, loss of inventory, zerk fire. The IAEA admitted to a 9-hour fire in the spent fuel pool. So compare that to what everybody else is saying. And somewhere along the line, there's a massive schism between on the one hand, that the spent fuel pool is they're going to unload the fuel. On the other hand, there's probably not any fuel left. You know, one of the two is wrong.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, you're talking about, and I appreciate that clarification, but you are pointing to documentation, which is the official.
This is the Freedom of Information Act. This is, anyone can go online, look at the documentation. On my book, I link on my multiple smaller articles and all my videos. I have plenty of links and everywhere. And like Michael Rupert said to a detractor who was accusing me of putting up fake emails and stuff, if anyone were to do that, that is a major federal offense that they will definitely throw your butt in jail, your door will be kicked in, and you're gone. So it's all drawn from the NRC Freedom of Information Act. And might I say, the information in there is so damning, and nobody needs to make anything up. Just what's already there paints an incredible picture of this grandiose orchestrated cover-up, whatever their reasons are for doing it. You know, and I'm working on that in my new book, is to try to give more reasons as to what's going on the global chessboard that's unfolding here.
Talking about the global, what about the effects in terms of the radiation that was released, the plume, all that's gone up over Japan and towards North America? Is there anything revelatory there that needs to be brought to the public's attention in terms of what was known at the time?
Well, at immediately following the accident, if you read those documents, you know just on their own testimony alone that they were aware there were some massive releases. I mean, they pretty much knew it was a worst, what they call a worst-case scenario. That means there's no water, no electricity, no coolant for days and days on end. I found a piece in there by Chuck Cass, who was the lead in the response team in Japan from the NRC, and he's been consistent all along that how severe the damage was early on. So if you, even without the FOIA documents, if you study Chernobyl and read the Costs and Consequences study, I link to this on my blog and website. If you read the one really legitimate study, you know that there's, you just don't get out of one of these accidents without there being some kind of effect as far as mortality rate, heart problems, mutation, genetic defects, leukemia, that kind of thing. If I take that and I just, in my mind, think about how Fukushima is playing out and the releases from all these source terms, what they call it, each reactor or spent fuel pool that would produce radiation, it's absolutely ridiculous to assert that there would be no effect over here. Like I say, there's been a number of studies now. You can look at the Sherman-Mangano mortality index study that's been revised and updated. There's an online activist, Bobby One, who has a very excellent, very well-researched mortality index study as well. And then you have recently the thyroid study that I believe Busby, Sherman, and Mangano participated in as well. And if you look close, you can hear about cancer clusters and starfish dying and all this. I mean, it's right in our face, but I think denial is some kind of coping mechanism for a lot of people, Michael, and they're just trying to cope right now. I'm not saying it's an extinction-level event. I'm not going that far because I don't know. I think a lot of people are in denial about the ongoing effects. They're kind of obvious to me. And keep in mind, let me finish here, that in the studies from Chernobyl, it's always like 5 years plus down the road that the latent cancers and effects really kick in. So we're just on the border, on the cusp of really feeling some of the effects from this catastrophe.
Mm. Now, as you mentioned, it's a requirement that in an emergency situation that all of the communications are documented. And that leads me to believe that, I mean, if there is a cover-up going on, that you're really kind of having to read between the lines, because I would imagine that people who know that they're being recorded would be kind of guarded in the way they convey their information. Even though there's a lot that's come out already, I mean, are you having any sense of sort of deeper things that are not being said that you're having to kind of piece together?
Okay, well, there's certainly redaction. For instance, there was a page that said spent fuel pool number 4 boil off calculation. And then you had 20 pages that were blank. Total redaction. So, no, I didn't get to see that. But when I combine that with everything else on unit number 4, I'm like, yeah, it's a lot worse than what they're letting on. And you make a great point. Not everybody's in on the conspiracy now. It's not that big of a conspiracy. On the lower level, I'm convinced some people are newbies and rookies just coming in. They don't know. One guy's almost kind of reprimanded when he gets carried away. And he's talking about unit 4. Melt on the floor. If it sublimates, will it go into the torus? And the guy says, hey, just so you're aware. He doesn't say, shut up, we're being recorded, although in one part I got, the guy says, hey, we're on a recorded line. You know, we need to take it to a non-recorded line, so they're aware they're being recorded. Some of them are actually, you're correct, they have to edit what they say. They're not as revealing. And I did a broadcast on Blog Talk Radio, my Blog Talk Radio show when I used to do it, where I talked about the NRC's response to a catastrophe is actually inhibited because some players are aware they're being recorded and they're editing what they say, and so they're not forthright and forthcoming with information, so the communication is inhibited. And I liken it to firefighters showing up at your house to put out a fire, and they can't say the word axe and they can't say the word hose. They'll still put the fire out, but it might not be in this short of time, if you understand.
Hmm. I would be watchful of those things that officials are saying among themselves, but they say something completely different to the wider public. Obviously, you have that blatant example with the spent fuel pool 4, but I think you also mentioned the whole issue of potassium iodide and you know, how they seem to stress it more when they speak among themselves than when they speak to the wider public. Have you come across several other examples like that? Or?
Well, that's very observant of you. Yes, what I found in the back of my book, Something Wicked This Way Comes, I have a section on potassium iodine, KI, and I've got a collection of screen captures from emails. For instance, I'm trying to think if it was Chuck Casto or who it was that had forgotten their stash of potassium iodine, and someone was trying to ship some out and get it to him as soon as possible, because throughout these documents, they make no bones about it. They don't leave here and go over there without their potassium iodine. Whilst on the public front, to my understanding, they're kind of, you know, indifferent about it and don't want the public to think they really need it. It only treats you for iodine and won't get you for other radioactive substances. Not that big a deal. But, you know, if you're in a pit full of snakes and there's six different snakes and someone gives you the antidote to one snake, well, that's only five left, and I'd rather only have five snakes after me than six. So.
Well, I guess that gets us to the question of motive. Just to try to clarify, what in terms of what your the exhaustive thousands of hours of research you've done into this, have you come to any conclusions about who is benefiting from covering up this information? Is it about basically straight, you know, protecting people's asses? Are they concerned that there could be a national panic and everybody's going to want to move from the West Coast of North America? Is there, you know, profits at stake? What's the ultimate motive here to this whole scheme?
Well, first of all, to be realistic, well, first let me say, yes, they protect the nuclear industry, obviously, but that's the obvious indication there, but they're also... the cover-up is, let's see how I phrase this. They're protecting the nuclear industry, yes, but to some extent, you can't be completely honest considering, considering our position around the world with all these nuclear plants and considering their vulnerability in relation to large population centers. This is what I want to say. You cannot be forthright and completely honest. You simply can't on the, Not to make excuses for our government, but if they came out and said, yes, we got to evacuate, you got to get out of Tokyo, or Indian Point's melted down, you got to get out of New York, it's not feasibly possible to evacuate those people. You just cannot do it. And so in their defense, I understand that. But my point in that is that just strikes to the fact we need an alternative source of power, and we need to dry cast this stuff and shut these things down as soon as possible. So the cover-up is twofold: protect the nuclear industry in the short term, but I mean, I think in the long term, we have to look at, we're going to have to shut this stuff down regardless. There's no other way around it, and I think they probably know that in the higher levels of government now.
I want to go back to what you were discussing right at the outset, that the Associated Press being responsible for filing so many of these Freedom of Information requests in the first place, and you having gone to all that trouble, and it doesn't seem like they're doing anything with it. I mean, Associated Press, that's mainstream, right? That's the biggest newswire in the world, I believe. And
that's correct, but when I'm told, I don't know who it is, but I'm told there's one person down there that continues to file and put this evidence on the NRC database. So while on the one hand it's true, Associated Press is not pulling from, you know, what I'm looking at, the worst of the worst in these documents, if anything at all. Someone down there is doing something and stockpiling for those who are willing to look into it. So it seems to me like somebody's trying to do something, while overall, yes, mainstream, totally silent across the board, and alternative media until recently has been very much silent across the board.
Oh, okay. So what just occurs to me as you're saying that is that they're looking to this information. They want the information, but not with the intention of disseminating it to the wider public.
Correct, because you have to understand that in those higher level positions or any position in the mainstream media, AP, ABC News, Reuters, whatever have you, they have to answer to their boss, and I've looked into this extensively. There's repercussions if you do try to... Okay, let me say this. In these documents, Michael, you can see where the NRC, and they spend millions to search press, could be mainstream, could be alternative. They want to know who's writing about them, who's talking about them. Throughout these documents, you see reports coming in on who's writing about Fukushima, who's writing about the NRC. It's mainstream, too. I've seen a couple articles come out in mainstream that weren't that shabby, but they get reported on, NRC knows about it, and they say in one of these emails after Fukushima that they watch social media, they got a feel for what's going on. They send their bloggers out to help set the record straight. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but that's generally what they do. They watch, it's reported to them, and they countermeasure and come out and, you know, I just read an article where Entergy spends millions to hire online PR people to convince us to relicense Indian Point, which is kind of like our Fukushima waiting to happen next to New York City, if you think about it.
Well, it looks like us truth tellers have our work cut out for us, given that kind of, those sorts of counterattacks that may be on the horizon. So what about, briefly, I mean, you've already made some forays into getting this. You've been at it for months, and you have the internet as the ally. You talk as an ally. You talk to Mike Rupert and Blog Talk Radio. What are some of the your experiences in terms of getting this to the wider public? The hits, the misses, some of the things you might caution against.
Well, my experience getting out to the public has been kind of frustrating because for the longest time I would send the information out and post on YouTube channels and try. I would do videos that were remixable. All you had to do was punch a few buttons and copy my video, and I found just an incredible resistance to this information going out. And I think there's more to it, though, Michael, in the long run. I hope this piece I'm writing now is going to shed more light on this global picture, why there's such silence. And I'll just hint right now, and you guys have shown this on Global Research. I've seen some good articles on there. I am more coming to understand the dynamics between some of these superpowers in the world and the corporations behind those superpowers and the needs of those corporations and what's going to be playing out on this planet in the future. And I've seen some channels on YouTube called Weather Wars and that kind of thing. That's what I'm interested in right now, these untraceable weapons, tsunami bombs, like General Cohen said, earthquakes induced by electromagnetics, volcanoes excited by electromagnetics. If you look back at the Icelandic volcano not too long ago, what was the end result of that? Well, it held up air traffic. People were stuck in airports. It brought an economy almost to a standstill. I'm thinking, hey, that could be an economic attack. What's going on this planet? So I'm kind of looking into that right now to see, is there this sublime, silent war that is unfolding on Earth right now between these superpowers, and resources are dwindling. And I certainly understand that from some of Rupert's work. So, and back in the day, I took an honors class based on Jared Diamond's book called Collapse. So I went back into that book and started looking at the Mayans and some of these reasons why civilizations collapse. It's very interesting and very revealing, and hopefully my next piece is going to shed more light on that.
Okay, well, Patrick Penry, Tony Muga, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you and to help bring your research forward. Again, your website is hattrickpenry.wordpress.com, and your book is Something Wicked This Way Comes. Is there anything else you wanted to relay to our listeners before we close?
You can catch me on YouTube, and I have some original songs. I really prefer to be a musician, but if there's need for someone to write, I'm willing to do that. And I just want to give you a word of thanks, and I want to give Global Research a little bit of praise, because really, by having me on now, as far as I'm concerned, in my humble opinion, you guys have really legitimized yourself as covering a very broad range of topics right now. I mean, I've seen almost anything and everything come across your website. So really, now you've gone into the FOIA documents, you've covered the Plumegate thing, and you guys are doing an excellent job.
Okay. We really appreciate that, Tony, and certainly we appreciate the hard work you put into this this effort on your part. So thanks again for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Tony Muga, otherwise known as Hattrick Penry. He has revealed a number of documents that have been put forward to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission relating to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. The nearly four-year-old Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster, which resulted in the dispersal of radioactive particles into the ocean and atmosphere, is an ongoing crisis, even though the impacts have been understated by governments and media. RADCAST is a citizen monitoring system that's regularly been recording radiation levels worldwide in the wake of the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, and its findings seem to be at odds with a lot of what we're being told by government authorities about the risks posed by the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. Mimi Gurman is a citizen activist, an earth activist, and a major mover and shaker behind RADCAST. She joins us now by telephone from Portland, Oregon, where she's based. She's here to acquaint us with the risks posed not only by the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, but by the nuclear industry at large. So, Mimi Gurman, welcome to the Global Research NewsHour.
Thank you so much for having me on. This is a really big topic, and it's one that doesn't get talked about often enough in the environmental movements. And I've been trying as well to get environmental leaders to talk about this more, because leaving this out is the elephant in the room. You can't not talk about this and talk about, you know, trying to do something for the environment. So yeah, I'm all yours.
Okay. Now, I just first of all wanted to just open up the discussion. There was a paper published last month in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and it includes the paper author is a Canadian researcher. This was published by the Fisheries and Oceans Canada. And it says from that government website, the first and only systematic study of its kind validating ocean circulation models while tracking the eastward movement of radioactive isotopes. And it says that since the Fukushima incident, radiation levels off the BC coast have increased to about 2 becquerels per cubic meter, and it's expected to peak in 2015-16 at about 5 becquerels per cubic meter of water. To put that in perspective, Canada's standard for cesium-137 in drinking water is 10,000 becquerels per cubic meter, meaning that the increase in cesium-137 in the Canadian Pacific waters do not represent a threat to human or animal health. So I guess I'm kind of curious to get your reaction to that apparently that apparent good news from this body.
Yeah, it's not good news at all. What they're saying is that they have found cesium in the water. And, you know, I have to say that we've had cesium in our oceans, 137 in our oceans from bomb testing, and we're still seeing that. And what we're looking for specifically from Fukushima is 134, cesium-134. And One of the things that we have to understand is how isotopes work. When they're in the ocean and fish are swimming in the ocean, fish ingest those particles. And we never know what fish, unless we've actually tested that fish, if that's been the case or not. But you have to assume. You have to assume that because the home of fish is in the ocean, that fish are getting affected from the radionuclides that have been put out, both from the bomb testing in the 60s and from Fukushima. So any amount of radionuclides, of cesium in the water, is going to affect the fish. And when we eat the fish, we get affected. So they can give us any low number they want and pretend that because it's lower than the standards in Canada, your standards, or here, the EPA standards in the United States, then everything is okay. It's not okay, because once you eat these isotopes, these radioactive isotopes, they go into your body and they lodge in certain places depending on what they are. And in this case for cesium, it ends up giving you any form of heart damage, tissue damage, anything like this. And when I say damage, it goes all the way to giving you cancer. So just because in the area of water that they've located radioisotopes, it's low there, it doesn't mean it's low everywhere. And just because it's low, it doesn't mean that it isn't harmful. What we know over decades of study from scientists is that even low amounts of radioactive particles are dangerous and can cause cancer and can kill you. We can never say about low doses that they cannot kill you. And because of that, we have to understand what is coming at us from the nuclear industry. And what's coming at us is, on one hand, a PR campaign that is funded by billions of dollars, and to keep telling us that things are low and comparing them to these astronomically high figures so that we see how low they are, and all the while pretending that we're fine, and we're not fine, and we're not going to be fine, and people are already dying of this, and they've been dying of this, and this is what's perpetuated. And all life in the ocean that is affected by this is going to be dying from this and is dying from this.
All life.
If you are a plant, and let's take seaweed. Seaweed can't continue to, you know, be, I suppose that, let me start this again. If a plant form in the ocean is affected by cesium and you eat that cesium, we are then affected. The plant life is not supposed to be eating cesium and you know, flourishing. Something is going to happen in the DNA structure of any form of living matter when dealing with radioactive nuclear isotopes. So, yes, all life that comes into contact with this will be affected.
Mm. I note that one of the you on your website, radcast.org, there's references to the research of Dr. Timothy Mousseau. Could you possibly elaborate or at least maybe accentuate the elements of his research that give us a sense of what is actually happening to these life forms as a result of cesium and strontium?
Oh, sure. Dr. Mousseau has been studying radiation in DNA in animal and plant life since Chernobyl and at Chernobyl and now at Fukushima. And what he's found is that not only is plant and animal life affected by radioactive isotopes, but the DNA structure is affected. So you might not see in one particular form of animal, let's say birds, you might not see something that looks wrong, but three generations from that bird, if you follow, you know, the progress of life from a particular bird family, you will find DNA issues in future generations. And we know now that this is true from his research. His research has been invaluable to us. And now he's over at Fukushima finding similar things. So
If you, just to clarify, so if you have some, this damage that takes place to an organism and then you move them to some isolated nuclear-free facility, those impacts are going to show up in the progeny anyway.
Yes, yes, because it's in the DNA. The DNA has now been messed with. It's no longer, you know, the healthy strands of DNA. It's been altered by these isotopes. And the alterations might not show themselves immediately, but they will show themselves in future generations, and they will be altered.
Mm. Well, that's pretty.
We also see that, too, in the children of Chernobyl. In all of the future generations that happened post the Chernobyl accident, we have seen these kinds of malformations in children being born and with birth defects and stillbirths and all kinds of fetal problems as well.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so and just in terms of, like, we'll get to the larger issue in a minute, but in terms of Fukushima itself, it's been almost 4 years now. Are we starting to see those results come in terms of the impacts it's having on people, on organisms and on human beings? We are, right?
Yes. We're seeing it in Japan, and we're seeing it on the West Coast, and we're seeing it in butterflies. And I encourage people to look up Dr. Mousseau, because he's the one who he's the forefront. He's the face of that research, and he's amazing. And it's peer reviewed, and you know his studies are well documented. Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes, we are being affected. We are dying from Fukushima. We are dying from Chernobyl. We are dying from Three Mile Island. We are dying from constant, incessant leaks from nuclear plants around the world, no matter where you live. We are dying from uranium mining, and the cancers are growing, and that is what's happening.
Mm. Now, what about some of the other – are there other major trouble spots that you'd like to mention perhaps in the United States, that there's the risk of another Fukushima that's on the horizon?
We have the risk of another Fukushima at any given nuclear power plant that's past its prime, which is all of them in the United States. So we shouldn't get I caution everybody to use language that makes it seem as though some nuclear plants are more safe than another, because that's part of the PR campaign. There's nothing true about it. There's nothing true from going backwards from the prevention of a nuclear accident at any of these nuclear plants. The nuclear accidents that we've seen have been human-caused. Some of the things that are happening now that we're seeing just recently, we're seeing freezing pipes in nuclear power plants now that our climate change is what it is. In the Midwest, we were just noticing that we're having issues at power plants because the water is freezing, the pipes are freezing, things are corroding. Sometimes things get too hot, you know. Sometimes there's floods. Sometimes there's droughts. Any of these things affects a nuclear power plant, and there's nothing that any of us can do about that except for one, and that is to band together and shut down every nuclear power plant that is out there, that is near us, that is far from us, anywhere. That's the only thing that can be done to help alleviate that particular problem, which is meltdown. The next issue that we have is what to do with the waste, and that is an issue unto itself. This is something that's going to be here far beyond human existence on our planet. The waste will survive us.
Yeah, and I know that I know, for example, that there's a major concern with the. Like one major red flag, I would say, would be one that you mentioned on the site, Diablo Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about how that specific risks, the clear and present danger threat that coming from that reactor to the nearby community?
Well, we, all of us on the West Coast, whether it's Diablo Canyon or here located near me is the Columbia Generating Station, we will be affected from earthquakes. The seismic studies that have come out have proven that there is no nuclear plant standing on the West Coast that can survive the major earthquake that we are expecting, which is a 9. And we're far overdue for that. And that's not me saying that. That's scientists saying that. I know that Portland is attempting, though not well, at fixing our city to, you know, to deal with the impending doom from this earthquake. But what isn't being done in California is Diablo is still standing. It's still running. What isn't being done in Washington is the Columbia Generating Station is still standing. It's still running. If and when that earthquake comes, Diablo and the Columbia Generating Station can so easily malfunction, and we can have an immediate shutdown. We can have an immediate meltdown. This is real. This isn't me being an alarmist. These are just facts with how nuclear power runs. The first thing everybody needs to know is that you need water to run a nuclear power plant, and you need the grid. And if the grid goes down and electricity gets cut off, welcome to our inner Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
If the drought affects something first, then there's no water. Welcome to the Fukushima in the United States or Canada or anywhere, you know. And we're dealing with these things now. California is a drought zone.
Mimi.
And it's sitting, and Diablo Canyon is sitting on an earthquake, you know, on the fault line. So, you know, and Columbia Generating Station is sitting on 12 fault lines. It's crazy. It is insanity to have these things up and running. And what do we hear? We hear more and more articles that the level of radiation that's being put out by Fukushima is safe. There is no such thing as safe radiation.
Mimi, could you help us understand the forces that are conspiring to, block these facts from public consciousness? Maybe, I'm thinking, for example, with the Hindenburg disaster back in the early 20th century, they were using hydrogen in dirigibles. There was a huge explosion, which, you know, if you thought about it, that's going to happen sooner or later. So the response was, we got to stop this using hydrogen in these things.
And yet with something like Fukushima, you'd think that would be we'd have that kind of, the humanity moment, and then proceed to stop building these things, let alone, you know, start to decommission these reactors. What is blocking our ability to act on, you know, the clear threat that's being posed?
Well, money. You know, and the fact here in the United States that the Supreme Court has dubbed corporations as people with rights, you know, to do whatever it is that they want to do. And so the money comes in and the laws get changed, which is what's happened here. All protective laws that we ever had, while, you know, perhaps too few even, you know, at the time that we had them, we no longer have. So we are an unprotected organism on the earth, we, the people and animals and plant life, from the corporation, which is Godzilla. Mm. And the corporation has its blood flow coming from and with the blessings of, in the United States, the Supreme Court.
What about oversight bodies or so-called oversight bodies, the EPA?
They don't exist. They don't exist. None of them exist. Oversight is, yet again, it's another term from the PR campaign. Oversight is supposed to be the DOE, the I'm speaking about the United States, the Department of Energy here is oversight. The NRC is oversight. None of these things are oversight, because there is no punishment when anything fails. And if there's no punishment for anything that fails, or to protect something from failing, you know, in order to protect people, there's just no oversight. But we have these terms. We have terms like the EPA. But when, you know, the EPA is run by people who are against the foundation upon which the EPA was built, we have no EPA. The FDA, the same way. You know, the vice president of Monsanto, it runs the FDA here. It's like that in any of these so-called watch groups, you know. So there is no oversight. They all work for one thing, and they all work for money. And again, I know that I might sound like a fanatic. These are just troops. I tell anybody, you go. Go into the NRC, talk to the NRC, call them up, they're accessible. Call them up and say, why didn't this happen? Whatever it might be that you find. And they'll tell you that it's not their responsibility. They'll tell you that it's the DOE's responsibility. Then go to the DOE. The DOE will tell you it's the NRC's responsibility. You know? And it goes on like this, no matter where you go. And I've done the calls, and many, many of the people in the anti-nuke movement have also done these calls. So we know this. Mm-hmm. So we are really, we are an organism. We, the living, the those with minds and souls and a desire to have a planet that is healthy and one that can make us healthy and thrive. We are aware that the reason that we are now riding in what we call now the sixth extinction is because we are run by greed, we're run by money, and we are run by the corporation. And because these are laws, there's nothing that we can do about it anymore except ride this out. So while we're here, you know, and while we're having these discussions, and people say, well, what can you do about it? Well, you can't do anything about the long run, but what you can do in the short run is try to shut down a nuclear plant near you, because at least that way, maybe you or your children or your children's children won't have to deal with, you know, a meltdown. Okay. And, you know, that's really where we're at. We're at a very, very terrible time. And it can't get better because no one has listened.
Mm. Yeah. So, well, it's a very gloomy prospect. And And I kind of wish we had a little bit more time to chat. Is there maybe a bit sort of like if people want more information in terms of taking action or just to satisfy their own understanding so they can orient themselves, your website?
Well,
or?
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of different sites that are up online, primarily Facebook sites. The one that we run out here is called No Nukes Northwest, and that's on Facebook, and that deals with our area primarily. Fukushima response is down in California. You can find that on Facebook. If you look up no nukes groups on the web, you'll find things. And you can join them and be part of the discussion and learn about what the nuclear industry is trying to get away with. And by the way, I did want to say just before we have to go, for folks listening to this and who are interested, if you hear the term small modular reactor, that's where the nuclear industry is wanting to head. They're wanting to forget about what they owe in the cleanup form to nuclear power plants, and they want to just forget that and move right into these things called small modular reactors. They are not safe. They are a death machine. So I'm just giving you the heads up on that. There's lots of research out there. Helen Caldicott has done some articles on SMRs and thorium, and I encourage you to look her up as well, Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Thank you very much for joining us, Mimi.
You're welcome. I'm sorry it's such a bummer, but it really is.
That's okay. Mimi Gurman is an Earth activist, and she's based in Portland, Oregon. And among the many websites she mentioned, she's also with radcast.org.
The website globalresearch.ca has put together a number of articles on the nuclear threat. In addition to an interactive reader on Fukushima, there is the prospect of a tactical nuclear weapons being used under a new post-9/11 nuclear doctrine. To tell us more, we have with us Michel Chossadovsky on the line from Montreal. He is the Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, and his most recent book is entitled Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War. Thank you for joining us, Michel Chossadovsky. Could you tell us more about this post-9/11 nuclear doctrine?
During the Cold War era, you had the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, which was called MAD, namely that you understood, at least people understood, that the use of nuclear weapons would result in the destruction of both the attacker and the defender. And what has happened in the post-Cold War era, but particularly in the post-9/11 era, is that the nuclear doctrine has been totally revamped. And I'm referring to a document, it's a very important document, which is called the Pentagon's 2001 Nuclear Posture Review. And this document actually envisages the use of so-called tactical nuclear weapons on a first strike use, not only against so-called axis of evil countries, including Iran and North Korea, but also against Russia and China. And what is at stake is the formulation of a preemptive nuclear war doctrine. It implies the development of new weapon systems, the billions and billions of dollars which have been allocated to nuclear weapons. And at the same time, they're now placing the emphasis on what are called mini-nukes or tactical nuclear weapons, which are smaller nuclear bombs, but nonetheless with an explosive capacity, a yield varying between one-third and six times the Hiroshima bomb. But what the Pentagon is saying is that these tactical nuclear weapons, which would be delivered with a bunker buster earth penetrator weapon system, are harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground. This is pure propaganda. What they have done is that they've changed the labels on the bomb in the same way as you would change the label on a cigarette pack and say smoking is good for your health. Now, another dimension, which is not well understood, is that nuclear war and nuclear doctrine have, in a sense, been privatized. Let me explain. Shortly after 9/11, 2 years after 9/11, August 6, 2003, which is Hiroshima Day. That particular day was chosen, August 6, 2003, to hold a secret meeting behind closed doors at Strategic Command Headquarters at the Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. And senior execs from the nuclear industry, I'm talking about the private sector, the meeting was intended to set the stage for the development of a new generation of smaller, safer, more usable nuclear weapons. As I mentioned, those are the mini-nukes. And these were to be used in theater alongside conventional weapons. And in essence, what has happened is that the dividing line between a conventional weapon and a nuclear weapon has been blurred, and now the mini-nukes can be used in the conventional war theater. They're part of what they call the military toolbox, the weapons tools box, and the decision to use them can be taken by a three-star general in the war theater within the system of geographic commands without necessarily having the clearance of the President of the United States.
It seems like what you're saying then is that up until August 6, 2003, nuclear weapons were essentially a bluff. If you attack us, we can hit you hard. But in this instance, you're talking about it actually becoming a normal, just another weapon that can be used in a conventional war, except that it would be nuclear. Looking at since I know your website has been monitoring the situation right now with Syria, Iran, the Asia pivot, how do you see this new nuclear doctrine with this new generation of weapons realistically being applied?
Well, first, let me say that I think that the preemptive nuclear doctrine predates 9/11. When they first started developing the so-called B-6111, which is a tactical nuclear weapon, it's a bunker buster bomb but with a nuclear warhead, the first country which was a candidate for its use was Libya during the Clinton administration. And they were going to use it to destroy an alleged weapons of mass destruction facility. And it was made public by the Pentagon, but ultimately that project was then shelved, and there's no indication that it was actually used in Libya. But these tactical nuclear weapons are fully deployed. In fact, they're deployed in several European countries, which are non-nuclear states. Belgium, Holland, Italy, Germany, Turkey have U.S.-made tactical nuclear weapons which are deployed, ready for use, and they're targeted at the Middle East. This is known and documented. And nonetheless, these countries are categorized as non-nuclear states, even though they have a weapons arsenal, which is made in America. In the context, let's say, of the war in the Middle East, the United States and its allies are indeed contemplating the use of nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, against Iran. This is an extremely dangerous situation because, from a decision-making point of view, it could get easily out of hand, and there's no consultative mechanism as during the Cold War era, you know, where you had a hotline between the Kremlin and the White House. You don't have that anymore, and the possibility for errors taking place and for a commander in the war theater, e.g., you know, in the Middle East, based in Doha and in Qatar, would possibly consider using tactical nuclear weapons, which are deployed and which are under various command structures.
And that was Michel Chossudovsky, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization.
That was the Global Research News Hour for this week. Global Research News Hour will be back with brand new episodes in September. My name is Michael Welch.